good morning, everyone, and welcome once again to The Other Side of Midnight. You know, that's that kind of special time after sunset and before dawn when the things that we, you know, look at in daytime and say, oh, come on, give me a break. When we look at this time of night, they take on a very different glow, and tonight is going to be no exception. In fact, it's going to be an exception because it's going to be kind of the quintessential essence of what this show has been about from its beginning. Before I get there, however, I do want to cover a couple of notes. First of all, I want to thank Dr. Robin Falco, for sitting in for me last week when I had that weird tickle in my throat on Tuesday morning that caused me to pop the mic down a lot and drink a lot of water, and it didn't go away. I had this awful feeling that something bad was going to happen, and it did. The next 4 days, you definitely would not have wanted to hear me on the air. But I'm all better. I'm back. And actually, there's a lot going on behind the scenes that I probably should take care of in some more detail tomorrow morning, which will give people a fuller view of what we're doing, because we're making some significant changes, and I want everyone to pay attention to your emails. All our archive subscribers, all the 19.5 club members, pay special attention to the email that Keith sent out a few days ago, because in order to renew your subscriptions, you need to follow the instructions in that email. And there will be more details to follow tomorrow morning. But I don't want to take any more time from my guests than we have to tonight, so we will not do that tonight. We will save that until tomorrow. But be reassured, things are moving in an extraordinary direction, and there are lots of positive developments to be reported. And I will do that in due course, hopefully beginning tomorrow morning. Okay. While I was gone, a few things have happened. Governments across the world have opened probes over something called the Panama Papers. 11,500,000 documents were leaked from a bank and a law firm. I guess it's just a law firm in Panama, which apparently had the contract for an extraordinary number of offshore accounts, which a lot of people, a lot of the 1% and the tenth of 1%, whatever, all over the world, apparently have opened up so they don't have to pay local taxes. Gosh, isn't that a surprise? And there are going to be many, many more shoes to drop on this centipede, so just stay tuned and stay focused, and again, remember what I've said. This is the year when extraordinary things are going to happen at an accelerating pace. That's what the physics kind of calls for, and if you look at the news, if you look at our election, if you look at the world, if you look at developments, that seems to be moving in the right direction as to what we had forecast. So, item number two I'm going to get to during the interview, because it's just something between my guest and myself that we will kind of discuss as we, you know, go through the morning. So without further ado, let me introduce who we're going to be talking to this morning, because this is an interview, a conversation that I have wanted to have for a very long time. Dean Radin is a chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, IONS, and volunteer faculty in the Department of Psychology at Sonoma State University. His original career track as a concert violinist shifted into science after earning a BSEE degree in electrical engineering, magna cum laude with honors in physics, from the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Oh my God, just up the street from where I used to live. And then an MS in electrical engineering and a PhD in psychology from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. For a decade, he worked on advanced telecommunications R&D at AT&T and GTE Labs, and for over two decades, he's been engaged in frontiers research on the nature of consciousness. Before joining the research staff at IONS in 2001, he held appointments at Princeton, the University of Edinburgh, the University of Nevada, Interval Research Corporation, and SRI International. Dean Radin is author of, or co-author of, over 250 peer-reviewed scientific and popular articles, 36 book chapters, and 3 popular books, including the award-winning and best-selling The Conscious Universe, from Harper One back in 1997, Entangled Minds, Simon & Schuster in 2006, and a 2014 Silver Nautilus Book Award, Supernormal, Random House in 2013. These books have now been translated into a dozen foreign languages so far. His technical articles have appeared in journals ranging from Foundation of Physics and Physics Essays to Psychological Bulletin and the Journal of Consciousness Studies. He was featured in a New York Times Magazine article and has appeared on dozens of television shows ranging from the BBC's Horizon and PBS's Closer to Truth to Oprah and Larry King Live. He has given over 350 interviews, that's 351 as of tonight, and talks, and includes an invited presentation at Harvard, Stanford, Cambridge, Princeton, and the Sorbonne for industries including Google and Johnson & Johnson, and for various U.S. government organizations, including the U.S. Navy and DARPA. Dean has spent, from 2010, about a month lecturing in India as a national visiting professor of the Indian Council of Philosophical Research, a program within the Indian government's Ministry of Human Resource Development. And in 2013 and 14, he gave invited lectures to Kuala Lumpur at the International Center for Leadership and Governance, an organization supported by the Central Bank of Malaysia. In 2015, he spoke at the Australian Leadership Retreat, a confidential program of briefings and discussions for Australian government, business, education, and military leaders. Dean Radin, welcome to The Other Side of Midnight. Hello?
Should be on.
You're on.
Oh, good.
Welcome.
Glad to be here.
You and I talked many, many, many years ago, and you gave me a problem, which I'm going to kind of save for kind of the middle of the evening. Mm-hmm. But I want to back up and begin with what moved you from physics and electrical engineering into something which is a little different, consciousness.
Well, when I was quite young, I read a little bit too many fairy tales, I think. And then a little older, I started reading science fiction. And somewhere in there, I guess my imagination was sparked. And while I was doing conventional work for some time, I never forgot that there were some very interesting things going on. And when I had the opportunity to start looking in more detail at consciousness in various ways, I jumped at the chance, and I never jumped back.
Well, you've actually brought something to consciousness studies that I don't know whether a lot of other people in the field have, and that is physics. The actual mm-hmm. ability to take technology, to take instrumentation, and try to figure out if we can measure this, you know, very ineffable quality called consciousness. What brought you to noetics? Well, before we start there, why don't we start by defining what the Noetics Institute is?
Sure. Well, noetic is the word nous, N-O-U-S, and it doesn't have an exact translation into English, but roughly it means inner knowing or intuition. And the word was selected by our founder, Edgar Mitchell, the Apollo 14 astronaut who passed away recently, as a result of an experience that he had in space, coming back from the moon to the Earth, where he had what he didn't know what name it had at the time, but it was basically a mystical experience where upon looking at the Earth from space, and at that time, you may remember, there were very few pictures of the full Earth from space. He looked at the Earth and felt that everything about humanity's history, about people that you've known, our future is all on that one little blue dot. And that sparked an experience where he felt a kind of unity with all humanity, which expanded very quickly into unity with the entire universe. And this wasn't an intellectual feeling. It was a palpable, full-blown, mystical union with the entire universe, which can't really be explained very well, which is why the mystics always say that this is an ineffable experience. But he was so startled by this experience in the middle of space that when he came back to the Earth, he decided that since his career to that point had relied on technology and science, to use the tools of science to figure out what in the world that kind of mystical experience is all about. So that was the formation of our institute, and for the past 40-some years, that's exactly what we've been doing.
Oh, my God, it's been 40-some years. I remember meeting Ed when I was at the Cape with a very famous Russian poet, Yevtushenko, and we kind of palled around together, a bunch of us. And, you know, that side of Dr. Mitchell, even at that time, was very evident, because he was talking different than an engineer. He had obviously this interesting epiphany halfway between the Earth and the Moon, and when he got back to Earth, he set up the Institute. When did you guys get together?
Well, the Institute started in 1973. It was around 1979 or 1980 that I had learned about the Institute, and I was at Bell Labs at the time, and I thought this was just great. Their mission was very simple. It was to explore the frontiers of consciousness. So I thought, that's a good mission. Hmm. So I became a member at that time, and I didn't really care exactly what they were doing. I just liked the idea that there was somebody somewhere that was seriously looking into the frontiers of consciousness. And an opportunity came in 2001 when I was working in Silicon Valley. An opening, basically, was created for me to create a laboratory at the Institute to do in-house research. And as I've done throughout my career, when an opportunity like that arises, you take it. So since 2001, I've been at IONS.
Hmm. A very providential year, according to an old friend of mine, Arthur Clark. Okay, so he gave you this kind of broad mission, explore consciousness. How, as a physicist, as a scientist trained in the hard sciences, how did you even begin to imagine you could explore something that's so ineffable?
Well, most of it is, I mean, a large chunk of it you can do from a psychological or a neuroscience perspective. So we use psychophysiological equipment, we use EEGs, we use all of the different methods of looking at the body's unconscious or the mind's unconscious by looking at reflection within the body itself. And then the other large chunk of it is in the domain of mind-matter interaction. And so you need some kind of physical system that you're going to measure and a way of seeing how that system changes as a result of intention being focused on the physical system. So that's where all of the engineering and physics comes in.
And what were some of the what were the entry points? In other words, when you were given this kind of mandate, obviously you thought to yourself, see now, what am I going to do? How do I? Because things like EEGs and PET scans and all that are kind of common even at that time. But you took it further. How did you break out of the traditional approaches and start off on the direction that you've ultimately wound up?
Well, the problem wasn't figuring out what to do. It was trying not to do everything all at the same time.
Okay.
There's a million things you can do. You can test. I mean, really, there's no end to what you can start looking at. But one of the first things that we started looking at was our laboratory analog of distant healing.
Ah.
And this is another way of thinking of it is it's like telepathy, but it's between bodies. And so they... What healers do, and we're talking about energy healers, people who do Reiki and Qigong and things like that, they have two claims, basically. One is that if they're working with a patient close, like within arm's reach, you can kind of think of that as a bioelectromagnetic effect. That the human bodies are basically bags of electrolytes, and there's all kinds of electrical things going on, and the fact that they would interact with each other is not that surprising if you're within around 6 feet.
But some kind of subtle electromagnetic effect or something.
Yeah, and not even so subtle, but real electrical and magnetic effects. So that's interesting. I mean, it may be pragmatically useful, but we took the next step, which was most healers will also admit, usually at night after a couple of beers, that they don't actually need to be next to the patient. They could be on the other side of the planet.
Hmm.
And the results, they say, are about the same. So this dramatically changes our interpretation of how are they interacting with the person if they're so far away? Because at that point, when you get 1 over r squared, there's hardly any electromagnetics left, and even magnetic fields, it's just not viable. That's what's going on. So I became interested in seeing if we could measure anything in a patient's body when the healer was strictly isolated by distance and by shielding. This is sometimes called the feeling of being stared at, because the easy way of doing this experiment is that you don't really want to use a patient, because then you have to think about medical effects, and it may not be ethical to do experiments where somebody's in real need.
Sure.
So you simply assign two people to participate in the experiment. If they know and love each other, it actually works a little bit better than if they're strangers. And you assign one of them the role of the healer and the other the role of the patient. You wire up the patient to look at as much of the physiology as you're interested in. Could be anything from skin conductance to heart rate to EEG and beyond. And now you point a camera at them, a one-way camera, so that it's going to send a signal out somewhere else. And at the distant location, you have the patient's live video image presented periodically to the person who's playing the role of the healer.
Mm.
And so this is called the feeling of being stared at, but it's over a one-way video link at a far distance. So the patient is then put inside a shielded room. So our particular room is 2,800 pounds of solid steel, double-walled, grounded, basically about as good a Faraday cage as you can possibly get. So we know that anything impinging on the patient is not going to be electromagnetic in nature, except for very low frequencies. Probably not magnetic fields either, because they're well shielded. And the game is, when the healer sees the live video image of the patient, the healer simply tries to connect mentally. You stare at the person, or you try to mentally agitate them or connect with them. And then there are periods when they don't do that. Generally 30 seconds to 1 minute staring, and then 30 seconds to 1 minute relaxing and without seeing the person on the video.
And the designated patient does not know what the timetable is, so there's no way they can correlate.
Correct. Since it's a one-way video, they have no idea when somebody is looking at them versus not. And so the question is, what is happening to the person being stared at, to the patient? What is happening to their physiology? Are they becoming more agitated when somebody's looking, or more calm, or what? So we've done many, many sessions, hundreds of sessions with couples in this kind of a context, and it's very clear from the evidence that we've produced and that colleagues around the world have produced that when another person is looking at you or even just thinking about you, that your body is usually producing a sympathetic arousal effect. It's as though when people in the real world talk about the feeling of being stared at, usually it's somebody staring and may not have very good intentions about staring.
Yeah.
Oftentimes a man staring at a woman, but not always. But what happens is that the nervous system becomes aroused, becomes activated. And that's what we see in these experiments as well. And what it tells us is that when healers say that they're able to interact with people, with patients at a distance, then they're correct. The patient's body will feel it. So this is an unconscious form of connection that apparently is not mediated by electromagnetics. It's probably not magnetic. And it doesn't seem to be mediated by distance either, because we see it regardless of how far apart they are.
Interesting. Now, did you do more than one person at a time? In other words, group focusing, group staring?
Informally, we would sometimes use multiple starers. And we always only had one person wired up as the patient. So that was one person, but we would occasionally have two, sometimes four or five people do the staring. And it wasn't clear that you got a linear increase. You'd get an effect, but you didn't get five times the effect if you had five people. And actually, we see this many times in lots of experiments involving some sort of mind-matter interaction, that there is a small increase when there are more people, but it's some kind of a nonlinear relationship that we don't completely understand yet.
So you weren't able to quantify how many people gives you what log, you know, increase in total effect?
No, because the people involved in the experiment, first of all, human performance varies wildly from one minute to the next, even in the same person. And it may be confusing on the part of the receiver of the intention that if you have multiple intentions and they're all slightly different, you may not respond the same way than if there's one intention. So it muddies the water more than it helps it.
So if the mediating mechanism of transferring this information is not electromagnetic, and that 2,500-pound steel box kind of rules that out, what do you propose is the operative mechanism of communication?
Well, that's the question, isn't it?
That's why I asked it.
Yeah, so from an electrical engineering perspective, we rule out basically everything except for extremely low frequencies. When we put somebody into one of our shielded rooms, from about 10 kilohertz and above, the room is completely opaque, so nothing gets in there. But 10 kilohertz and below, there are signals getting through. So this possibly means that the connection is through extremely low frequency electromagnetics. I suspect that is not the case, and I could describe why in a minute.
No, please, we have time.
Okay, so for many, many years, it was thought that telepathy and these distant connections were mediated by electromagnetics because that was the only thing that people could think about. The Russian Vasiliev back in the 1930s and up to around the 1950s did these similar kinds of tests, both telepathy and physiological connections, where the receiver in the experiment was in not only steel Faraday cages, but very heavy lead-lined, very thick lead-lined Faraday cages that were able to block even lower frequencies and either at farther distances. And he didn't find any evidence at all that mattered. The shielding did not work. But more importantly, there have been remote viewing tests between people, one in a submarine at 300 or 400 meters of seawater, and the other person up on the land.
Oh, I remember that. Who was it was telling me that years and years and years ago?
It may have been Stephen Schwartz.
Yes, Stephen Schwartz. Yes, he described this, and they took this thing down at great peril and great expense and all that, and what they expected to happen didn't happen.
Right. So seawater is very effective at certain depths of getting rid even of ELF. And so,
well, don't tell the U.S. Navy, because there's a whole, you know, state of Wisconsin which has been wired with very ultra-low frequency cabling to communicate with our nuclear, you know, forces underwater.
Yeah.
If ultra-low frequencies can be shielded by seawater, how does that – I forget the name of the project. It has some weird name. Anyway, but the idea was to transmit ultra-low frequency radio, very low bit rate, but you could penetrate – maybe 100,000 feet down, I forget the exact number, using ultra-low-frequency electromagnetic radiation.
Yep, and if you are monitoring electromagnetics, you can actually see that signal down at somewhere like 19 hertz. It's still there. It's like a beacon. But in order for the submarine to receive it, it has to trail a wire that's miles long.
Okay, so the antenna has to be a couple with the wave.
Right. So if you have a wave at the ELF level, which could be miles long, and the human is only maybe 6 feet long, the coupling just won't work.
Okay.
And that's beside the fact that at very low levels of seawater or deep seawater, the amount of energy in the ELF wave is extremely small. So you have these super amplifiers and these super long antennas to be able to pick anything up. And the bit rates are very, very slow. So if you think about what is being communicated in something like a remote viewing test or between people at a distance, the bit rates have been calculated, and they're much, much faster than would be carried by an ELF wave.
You mean the operational, actual, empirical data says that that's not what possibly could carry the information?
it won't carry enough. It won't carry it fast enough, even if the human body could act as an antenna, which it can't.
Okay, so we're back to Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah. So what's left? So the only thing that we have left at this point is probably more of a metaphor than a viable theory, and that's quantum entanglement. Because there, if you imagine that people can be entangled in the same way that elementary particles can be entangled, then there is no literal transfer of information. It's more that the two people seem to be different, but they're actually not quite as different as they appear to be. And so the secondary evidence or indirect evidence that something like that may be going on is because when you do experiments with couples, you usually get much better results if they're long-term loving couples than strangers.
Which is a form of entanglement in and of itself.
Well, exactly. So long-term entangled couples have touched each other a lot. They share a lot of material within their bodies, which maybe that produces something like an entanglement. And even emotions may produce an entanglement. And the downside of what I just said is that sometimes we have strangers do this kind of experiment, and we don't know that they have ever touched each other, and they show effects as well. So then you have to imagine that everything is entangled all the time, which some physicists believe is the case. And if that is true, there's some kind of entanglement going on all the time, and we live in a fully holistic environment, then the reason why we see these effects in the laboratory is because the entanglements were already there. And that means that we're not creating a magical connection in the laboratory. We're simply looking at it in a way that we can see it. But these kinds of connections must exist among everyone all the time.
Do you believe in reincarnation?
Well, that's quite a jump from
No, it's actually very connected, you know. And it's kind of a yes-no question. So do you or don't you?
Well, I believe that the evidence, the case studies, are intriguing and suggestive of some kind of connection between you and yourself at a different time.
Okay. So if reincarnation is possible, is it possible that so-called strangers this time around were not strangers the last time around or the 100th time around or whatever? In other words, we're looking at entanglement on a scale so big that our terrestrial experience really can't encompass the idea of real entanglement.
I see where you're going with that. If we're dealing with some kind of entanglement, then sure, because entanglement works through space as well as time.
Okay, hold it there. This is fascinating because we're building, out there, we're building to what I want to get to in the next segment, which is Princeton, the eggs, and what you discovered with that extraordinary experimental protocol. My guest this morning is Dean Radin. He is head of consciousness studies at the Noetic Institute, and we are going to have a lot of interesting conversation this morning. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. We are back on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Dean Radin, and we are discussing consciousness. How does one measure something as abstract as consciousness? So, Dean, please continue.
Okay, well, you're interested in the Global Consciousness Project.
Well, when did you actually get connected with the Princeton group that was setting up this instrumentation? And obviously, for this audience, you probably need to describe what the experiment is. But it was sometime around the same time frame, wasn't it? 2001, 2002?
No.
Oh.
I was at Princeton from 86 to 89. and had a lot of opportunities then to interact with the pair group, the Princeton Engineering Anomalies.
So this preceded your move to Noetics?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So being at the pair group, and I wasn't in it, but I was in the psychology department, but I spent a lot of time with Roger Nelson, and I watched the studies they were doing involving random number generators, which was their instrument for looking at mind-matter interaction. And they were very interested, like a lot of people were at the time, on what is going on here, because the evidence was pretty clear that if you intend the random numbers to go one way, they would do that. If you intend them to go somewhere else, they would do that too. So a question like you were asking before, well, how do you explain this? So
yeah,
if
you rule out EM, electromagnetics, what's left in known physics?
Mm-hmm.
Dean?
Yeah, your voice faded for a second. So
We're having Skype issues tonight for some reason.
I see.
Anyway, what I said was, if you ruled out electromagnetic, you know, waves as a transfer of information for this, mm-hmm. what's left in known physics?
Right. What's left? As I said before, the only thing that we can think of at this point is it's something like entanglement. It probably is not what we think of in the physics lab as elementary entanglement, like between photons, because we're talking about very large systems, which mostly are acting like classical systems. And yet the means of communication does not appear to be any of the normal forces. So we're kind of stuck. When it comes to, and the same question then arises when your target is not a human, but a physical object like a random number generator.
Skype again.
Random number generators began to be used as targets is because the underlying randomness was quantum.
Ah, okay.
Inside most random number generators, not all, but most of them, are diodes. And these are Zener diodes in which the diode works because of electron tunneling. And that's a quantum phenomena. It's a wave-like phenomena of the electron that allows it to tunnel through a portion of the diode that it shouldn't be able to get through if it was operating classically.
Mm-hmm.
So this is then a mind-quantum interaction. The quantum nature of the electron is creating little pops, basically, and the pops are turned by circuitry into numbers or to bits.
Which if you were to look on a TV screen, would appear like white noise.
It would look very much like white noise, yeah. So in that case, the reason that these devices started to be used was to look at the role of mind in quantum behavior, which has been a puzzle from almost the very beginning of quantum mechanics. So after doing studies like this for many, many years, the Princeton lab said, well, maybe what's going on here is not intention, which was thought to be originally. It's your will somehow pushes the bits around. Maybe it was simply attention. You attend to the device, and it creates a negentropic effect. It reduces the amount of noise.
We're back to staring.
We're back to a kind of staring, and in this case, the staring would be assumed that the attention alone would actually produce a kind of coherence in the noise and reduce the amount of noise. So in order to test that idea, Roger and others were starting to experiment with what they called a hidden target. They would take one random number generator that the person would know about and give feedback from that generator, but there was another one, maybe even right next to it, that the subject didn't know about.
Ah, your
and
control.
So the question was, what would happen to the so-called control that nobody knew about while the other one was being intended to or attended to?
Gives a whole new meaning to the term hidden variable.
Yep. And so to everyone's surprise, it turned out that not only did the one that people knew about change, but the hidden one also changed.
Ah.
And so this gave the notion that maybe it really is attention, and attention acting as a kind of a field effect.
So if you're focusing, if you know you got a random number generator, a piece of electronic gadgetry, and you're going to kind of focus on it and try to get it to go non-random, the very act of doing that with one that one also is communicating to all the others?
Not so much communicating, but more as though attention is a kind of a field. So in the process of attending to one thing, everything in the vicinity is picking up this field effect, which is negentropic, or order-producing. And this again, is a hand-waving explanation, but it sort of makes sense, because you think about what are the properties of consciousness. Well, one of those properties is producing order in systems. And this was an idea I came up with, where just simply trying to think of any explanation here, that one of the primary differences between a body that is alive, a human body that's alive versus dead, is the presence of consciousness. And so consciousness acts as a kind of an ordering principle, an ordering force or field that keeps the body alive and produces negentropy. It reduces the entropy that when the body, as soon as consciousness goes away, the body begins to fall apart. And I'm not talking only about conscious awareness, but also deep levels of unconscious. So that was kind of a guess. And from that, Roger Nelson got the idea that, well, why don't we put random number generators in the vicinity of people who are attending to something, but not even knowing that the generators are there. So he did a few studies. It was getting amazingly good results, that whenever an audience was attending to something, you'd start seeing the random generators behaving less randomly.
You mean like a major concert or something?
A concert, a choral group, theater, those kinds of things, or meditation.
So
groups.
Mass attention. Now you still have these little random number generators, the so-called eggs. By the way, what is the technical acronym, egg?
It stands for electrogyogram.
Ah.
And the idea was that we're putting electrodes on Gaia's head.
Ah, yes. Okay. Mother Earth. All right.
Yes.
So you scatter these. Now, were these initial experiments, they just put them kind of around the auditorium or around the theater or around whatever you were, you know, where people were gathered?
Yes.
So there was also proximity.
Yes. And at the time we thought, well, maybe it is a proximity effect, that you need to be near the people who are having this strong attention, and we had no idea how far it spread out. So the reason for making a worldwide version of this, the Global Consciousness Project, was for a number of reasons. One was that previously we only could test things where we knew in advance that there was going to be a large number of people or even a small number of people, but that they were all focusing on the same thing at the same time.
How long did it take to go from local, you know, theater wiring, hidden wiring, to the globe, the planet?
It took a couple of years. We started with, I think, 3 generators, and then it became 5, and then it increased over the couple of years and peaked at around 75.
And the idea is that any 1 or 2 or even 20 or 30 could be random, but if you get them all to do the same thing at the same time, you reduce statistically the odds that you're looking at chance?
No, you could have a very significant effect with 20 generators.
No, I meant out of your total, whatever your total number is, the larger the number of detectors, let's call them detectors, the better the statistics of proving that something unusual was occurring?
Not necessarily.
Oh.
Because one of the measures is cross-correlations. No, when you're dealing with one random number generator, there's nothing to correlate against other than somebody's attention.
Sure.
So you just have one physical device. If you have 2 devices, you can start looking at not so much the deviation from chance within a generator, but the behavior of both generators. Do they both begin to deviate in the same way? So if you have 20 generators scattered all over the place, you can do the same game. You can say, well, we don't care what's actually happening in any given generator, but we do care that all of the generators are moving in the same direction, as though they're floating in an ocean of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So
at least that was your model going in, right?
Yes. And so we now have something like 500 major worldwide events that have been studied since 1998, I guess, when we put it together. And we're beyond a 7 sigma result.
Wow.
So that means the odds against chance are beyond a trillion to one at this point.
So how come this isn't a major New York Times headline? People are connected. The planet is connected. Terrorists, you are connected. Every time you kill somebody, you kill a part of yourself. In other words, why isn't this mainstream science if the numbers are so incredible?
It's a very good question, because the Higgs boson was detected, even though it's actually not the Higgs, but that particle, that unusual particle, was found at about a 5 sigma result.
How about the LIGO results, which are even worse?
Yes, they're both about 5 sigma results. And these are earth-shattering and get worldwide attention for a very simple reason.
And how
much predicted.
And how much better are your results?
Ours are 7 sigma.
Well, what, for non-mathematical people, what does that mean?
Oh, so okay, so 5 sigma is somewhere around 100,000 to 1, odds against chance.
Okay.
7 sigma is beyond a trillion to 1.
Holy cow, and the New York Times doesn't care.
The New York Times doesn't care for the same reason that most scientists don't know anything about this, and that is that we don't know how to explain it. And also, it wasn't predicted.
Yeah, but Dean, there's been a lot of phenomena in science where we didn't have a clue, and it became adopted before a theory was worked out.
If it had pragmatic import. So in this case, this is challenging the major paradigm within science. Within science today, there's still some neuroscientists who don't think that consciousness even exists. So we're talking here about something which is a major challenge to the model of reality that most scientists hold, which is that consciousness is either a meaningless side effect of brain activity, or maybe it's meaningful, but it's still stuck inside your head and it doesn't do anything. What this kind of experiment, in fact, all of the experiments that we do, all suggest that consciousness is fundamental in some way. And until we have some kind of a way of explaining exactly what we mean by that, and of course nobody has any idea at all how you get consciousness, where it comes from, what is its actual relationship to the brain? All of these questions, these are major unknowns, then it's very difficult to penetrate the mainstream ideas. And so people who pay attention to the data, like I do, say, well, clearly something is going on, but science hasn't caught up with it yet.
If in your healing work, and I want to get back to that for a second because it leads to this next question. If in your healing work, your synthetic healing work, you found that more numbers of people focusing did not really increase the effect or predictably increase the effect, why would you think, jumping now to the global consciousness idea, why would you think that billions of people resonating to some particular event in their consciousness would have more of an effect than one person, let's say in Paris during one of those terrorist things, having a shattering experience? Why would the numbers matter?
Actually, we're not sure that it does matter. So from an experimental point of view, we would love to do an experiment where we had a billion people staring at one person. And the only way we can think about doing something like that is through live television broadcast, mm-hmm. Where we wire somebody up and simply see whether that person reacts differently when the video is on them versus not. And so we can't do that because TV people don't.
Oh, you dropped out again.
Experiment, which we're developing.
I'm sorry, Skype dropped out. Can you read that whole last part, please?
Okay. So it's very difficult to do an experiment which we want to do, which is to wire up somebody, point a video camera at them, and then broadcast it out so a billion people are looking at them. And, of course, unbeknownst to the person who's the patient or the target in this case. And that way we would be able to see that is there a much bigger effect in somebody who's being stared at by a billion people. The most we've ever done in the lab is about 4 or 5. Hmm. And there may not be enough to see a big effect.
Why can't you do this with the World Wide Web?
We could, but even then we may get 1,000 people at the same time. It's simply something that we haven't done. But here's something that we are going to try, and we're in the process of developing it. You would go to a web page, and you would look at a video broadcast. It could be some TV show or something of that sort. And it's either live or it's pre-recorded. So if it's live, we choose something where there are at least millions of people watching simultaneously, And if it's pre-recorded, there may be, you may be the only one who's watching it.
At that moment.
And the task is, can you feel a difference when a million people are watching the same thing that you are? In other words, your attention is along in alignment with other people's attentions as compared to when you're watching a show and no one else is watching it. So that would give us a clue as to whether or not there is something different about millions or billions of people all in alignment at the same time as compared to when they're not.
Well, again, coming at this anecdotally from just a general kind of knowing what people are thinking in this business, Peter Jennings, many years ago, when we have these national crises where CNN is broadcasting 24/7 and MSNBC and Fox and the major networks are breaking in and all that, he called this the national campfire. Mm-hmm. And he strongly insisted, you know, God rest his soul, that there was a difference between a live event where everybody is connected through that consciousness, that attention to one thing, and something on tape, something that's pre-recorded, something that you can look at any time. Now, that's totally qualitative. That's just from a guy who was in the business for decades, but he felt strongly, and he talked about it several times, he talked about it as the national campfire effect, that live means people know somehow that an awful lot of other people are watching the same thing, and it makes a difference.
Right. Yeah, and that's why we think that the Global Consciousness Project is working. We have not just a handful or dozens, but millions, or in some cases hundreds of millions of people who are engaged in a giant experiment, and our generators respond.
So you say now you have about 500 incidents or events that you've looked at scientifically, mm-hmm. statistically. Kind of give us a quick overview of how they started and where we are now with that train of thinking.
Well, the idea in this experiment is that we have the generators running all the time. And it was designed this way because we would never know in advance if some major event was going to happen that we didn't know about, like a terrorist activity or an earthquake or something. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to be able to capture those events.
Let me stop you there, please. Do you differentiate between positive events and negative events?
Yes, and also natural disasters and human disasters.
Okay.
So any event that we decided, usually it's Roger that's making the decision, but sometimes it's other people who made suggestions as well. If there was something big coming up or something actually occurred, then before the data is looked at, a decision is made as to how long a period of time should be looked at the time of that event. So to give an example, if you have something like 9/11, the event itself took maybe an hour, but the impact of it would be quite long. So that was an event that we simply said, well, let's look at a 24-hour period that started a few hours before the event and then going for 24 hours. Whereas if you have something like an earthquake, similarly, you look just before the earthquake and maybe a couple hours afterwards. And sometimes you only have an event that may last an hour, sometimes longer. So that decision is made. And once it's made, it's locked in. You're not allowed to change it. At that point, you go in and retrieve the data from the network, and you do a standardized analysis on it, and the results are whatever they are. And that's how we end up with 7 sigma. So we're not fishing for interesting results. We're pre-stating what we're going to look for, and then the results are whatever they are.
Hmm.
So the advantage of this is that we can't be accused of data snooping because there is none. The disadvantage is that we're not always clear that we're analyzing it in exactly the right way. And so this has allowed us to go back after the fact and do post hoc analyses of different events and use different methods to see if we can pull more signal out of the noise.
Kind of like the Bureau of Labor Statistics when they revise the employment numbers a month or two later.
Yeah, and of course if it's post hoc, then it doesn't really count so much. So we use the post hoc analyses to give us clues about understanding what is going on, but it's not part of the formal result.
But that automatically implies you somehow think this is linear 3D reality based, and you have one astonishing result, which is the World Trade Towers, that clearly says that something is out of time, something is out of sequence, something is not causal in terms of our understanding of how time flows. You want to talk about that a bit?
Well, because in that particular case, roughly 3 hours before the towers were hit, we already saw a pretty significant deviation.
And
it's kind of suggesting that there's a large-scale presentiment. People could feel something bad about to unfold.
Hmm. And that gets us very close to precognition.
Right. So this would be a very large-scale, unconscious feeling among the many, many people that something was about to happen. And it's not always clear that, you know, if you were to do a running analysis, the same analysis just throughout the entire database, you will find it looks like very much like a random walk. And what our 7 sigma result is saying that the random walk happens to deviate for reasons we don't have a good explanation yet, but it just happens to deviate more strongly in a certain direction when these big events occur. So it's possible that what we see that looks like a precursor, it might be, it kind of seems that way, but we're not absolutely sure that that's the case.
Hmm. And how would you design a protocol to figure out what is what?
Well, we did an analysis, for example, where we took all earthquakes of magnitude 6 or above that occurred either on land where there were people or in the ocean that did not result in a tsunami. And then analyzed that chunk of data, many of which we did not previously analyze, but fortunately we keep all the data so we're able to go back and look at it in a historical sense. And what was found was that when earthquakes occurred on land where there were people who were involved, that there did seem to be a precursor. And when they occurred in the ocean, there was no precursor. And there actually wasn't even a deviation. So it suggests that the fish don't care about earthquakes, but we care a lot.
Okay, that's fascinating.
So that's one way to do that kind of a test.
Now, have you tried looking? I mean, you've got a huge amount of data now. If you started this in 1998, you said?
Yes.
So that's a huge amount of data. Mm-hmm. And a huge amount of data means you can really work it with statistics to milk every last bit out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Have you looked at astronomical correlations, planetary positions, galactic, you know, movement or location? In other words, have you looked beyond the idea of consciousness to something in the solar system, in the galaxy, in the Virgo cluster, somewhere beyond us for why this random background would change without consciousness intervening?
Mm-hmm. There have been some looks at things like lunar phase and geomagnetic field changes, some a little bit on astrological configurations and planetary positions, and none of them show anything systematic. As far as I know, no one has looked at farther out areas like other galaxies or our position within the galaxy and those sorts of things. The joy at this point is, as you said, we have a huge amount of data. The non-joy is that we have a huge amount of data.
Is that called the poverty of riches?
Yeah, it's an embarrassment of riches, yeah. So the database is large enough now that if you're working at the level of individual samples, which is the data per second, we squash the data into per second, it's many, many, many gigabytes now. So it's difficult to pull the entire thing into a computer, even modern computers with huge amounts of RAM. So you have to squish it, and every time that you compress the data in some way, of course, you're going to lose something. Nevertheless, you can actually get the entire database into a computer and look at models like, does it matter where the star Sirius is or where something else is? There aren't that many analysts who are interested in doing this.
Hmm.
And, of course, the nice thing about this project from the very beginning was that we made all of the data publicly available. So if you go to the website and you could download literally the entire thing. At this point, it's probably about 100 gigabytes.
So you could do privately what the SETI at home people have done and several other projects now, where you basically, get crowd-sourced input to look through data in ways that you either don't have time or might not even imagine to look.
Yes, that could be done in principle. At this point, there's probably five or six of us who pay attention to this, and we would need more time and funding than we have in order to create something like a crowdfunded instead of SETI at home, it would be like a global consciousness at home project. But it could be done.
But wouldn't that be an incredible idea? I mean, you involve democratically all kinds of people all over the planet, all wired together, looking at, I mean, to me, the upside seems incredible. How much funding would it take to set that up?
Oh, it probably would take something like $20,000 or $30,000, the vast majority of which is salary, because, you know, if we're going to dedicate someone or a couple people to this project to get it to the point where you can do that analysis and have it to be meaningful, somebody's time has to be paid for.
Hmm. I'll tell you what, hold it there. I want to come back to this when we come back. My guest this morning is Dean Radin from the Noetics Institute. We're discussing one of our favorite subjects here, consciousness, the physics of consciousness, the physics of measuring consciousness. And because everything around consciousness seems to be a bit ambiguous, the measurements, surprise, surprise, are also ambiguous at the moment. But maybe that will change. Maybe with your help, that could change. 20,000. Dean, that's nothing. Good grief, that's nothing. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and yes, we shall return.
There's a piece of sky money cannot buy, a different shade of blue. There's a plot of land not owned by any man, a mountain with a view.
And we are back on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning, Dean Radin. And all you conscious folks who are calling in, if you want to ask Dean a question, let's hold them until the bottom of this hour, because I have a few more myself, and everybody can then play. I do have one I want to insert here, which was emailed to us from one of our regular listeners, Tim. He says, if people are watching a live event, is the feedback energy dynamic, meaning I think open-ended. And then he says, whereas if people watch a pre-recorded, then perhaps the energy feedback has already been predetermined?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Something like that may produce a difference in how we feel about the program. And, of course, we have to use programs that you can't figure out whether they're live or not. So we're thinking about, for in the United States, for example, that we might show a popular Russian soap opera that people here generally don't track. And then you can't tell, is this broadcast live or maybe it's a replay of something else. Mm-hmm. That's we will be able to answer questions like, does it matter? Can you feel that there's a lot of people who are focused on the same thing? And we kind of felt that, in the case of 9/11, I've heard from people that I know that they were not aware yet of what was happening because they hadn't turned on the radio or anything, but they felt very strange, suggesting that there is something like a large focus of attention that people can feel.
Was this people just in New York or all over the world?
All over the world. In fact, my mother mentioned to me that the morning, she woke up in the morning and had not turned on the TV or the radio or anything, and she felt that her blood pressure was through the roof. Huh. She took her blood pressure, and she had been taking it periodically, and sure enough, there's like a spike in blood pressure, and then she turned on the news. She actually called the doctor first because she was concerned, but then she turned on the news, and then her blood pressure went back to normal after she learned what happened.
So it was the uncertainty that may have contributed to her physiological state.
Well, or her sense, given that she didn't know what was happening in the rest of the world at that point, that she unconsciously felt that there was something horrific unfolding, and that's why her blood pressure went crazy.
I want to go to your book, because obviously now you've written a book which kind of puts a lot of this together and a lot more, and it involves, you know, Eastern traditions, classical, if I can use that term, you know, efforts at studying or understanding consciousness. Why don't you talk a bit about the new book? Because to me, the synthesis of what you're doing is incredibly important. The book is called Supernormal, Science, Yoga, and the Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities.
So my two previous books were mainly giving a survey of the field of psi research. The first book was...
Psi being the Greek
psychic
term for...
Yeah. Psychic phenomena.
Psychic phenomena, okay.
And of course, curiously, the psi function in quantum mechanics is the same word and might even have the same meaning.
Isn't
we're not quite
that
sure yet.
Fascinating? Yes.
Yeah. So the first two books was talking mainly about psi research and how we know that there are some real effects and how science has studied it. The second book focused a little bit more on the physics. And in this third book, I became interested in the idea that we now have tens of millions of Westerners doing yoga. And the yoga in the West is kind of a semi-spiritual aerobics.
With a bit of suburbia tossed in.
Yeah, a little bit. And special clothes and special things. And, you know, it becomes Westernized very quickly.
Mm.
But
with a very long product chain and all the other things you need to buy before you can do proper yoga.
Right. If you don't have the right kind of clothes, you can't do it. So even with a crass Western approach to it, it is very valuable. And some yoga studios will, at the end of the exercise portion, will do meditation. So many, many people are beginning to meditate. Meditation now is being used by the U.S. Army, by banks, by you name it. It's known now with a lot of research for being very good for mental and physical health. But as often happens when we absorb something from another culture, the essence of the purpose of meditation and yoga is lost. So I knew a little bit about yoga and meditation, and I decided to write a book about the relationship between what yoga is really about and how it figures in with psychic phenomena. And so that was the point of this book. And I focused on what's considered to be the classical book of yoga, which is a book written by a yogi sage named Patanjali about 2,000 years ago. And what he did is, as you can imagine, books were not mass-produced back then. So he had to write the book in terms of little paragraphs. There's like almost 200 little paragraphs in four books.
Oh, kind of like suras.
Well, pithy phrases. Little phrases. In Sanskrit, of course, because that's what they had back then.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first written form of what to that point had been an oral tradition. So it's estimated that maybe the oral tradition was around for several thousand years before Patanjali wrote it down 2,000 years ago. And the reason why I chose that book is because, among other things, it describes what is yoga really about. What people do as yoga today is mostly poses, asanas. And this is what yoga is about. And, of course, the stretching is very nice, and it's good for your body and so on.
So you're talking about physical poses, physical movements.
Yeah, the physical movements. That's what people think that yoga is about. And that is what it's about in the Western world, and actually even increasingly worldwide, including in India.
Well,
they have Olympics of poses in India.
Well, that's why you have to have the right clothes.
Yeah. No, because they could split, and that would be bad. So the original purpose of the poses and the breathing and all the rest of it was to allow the body to become strong enough so you could sit long enough and meditate.
Ah.
To meditate hours and hours and hours every day. And the point of all that was to achieve a state called samadhi, which is the same kind of mystical union that Edgar Mitchell felt when he was coming back to the earth.
Ah, the kind of oneness, you mean?
Yes, a unity experience, a unity with everything. So that was the point where the real juice in yoga begins. Once you are able to achieve this samadhi or mystical state on demand as a result of lots of yoga and meditation practice, you're then able to start the siddhis. And the siddhis is a Sanskrit term that means attainment or perfection. And these are now indicators that you're achieving a certain state of transcendence. You're able to transcend the limitations of the body and of the physical world and begin to enter other realms. So one of the very first siddhis or powers that is written about in the Yoga Sutras, there's a whole book, one of the three, there are four books of the Yoga Sutras. The third book is completely devoted to these special powers that come about as a result of this intense practice. And the very first one is called, in Sanskrit, I don't remember exactly what the Sanskrit term is, but the upshot of the translation is that you gain the ability to perceive past, present, and future all at the same time.
Oh my.
So perceiving the past we would call memory. Perceiving the present is pretty obvious. Perceiving the future we would call precognition.
And we're back to 9/11.
Yes. And this is then the most elementary siddhi that is developed as a result of meditative practice. But only after you've achieved this rarefied state of samadhi.
And most Westerners do not go that far, I presume.
Well, people have different talents. Some people can start meditating and learn that they're very talented. They just have an affinity for this sort of thing. And they can achieve samadhi fairly quickly. But it's rare. It's even rare among the yogis. Because the yogis have said that people who are able to do even extended meditations, they will begin to experience increased synchronicities. They'll have much better connection between the mind and their own body. But not everybody's going to achieve the siddhis. We did a survey among 1,000...
By the way, you should probably spell that because it sounds like you're saying city, C-I-T-Y, but you're not. It's spelled C-S-I-D-D-I, I believe?
S-I-D-D-H-I.
H-I.
Yeah, yeah. I like to say that they use the phrase of "We built this city on rock and roll," which is a strange song because it was simultaneously the best and the worst song out of the 1970s. I think.
I love that song.
Yeah. Well, many people loved it, and a lot of people hated it. It's a very odd song. So, in this particular kind of city, it's basically a prescription. Of how, if you want to develop something like levitation, then you do a particular siddhi. You do practice in order to develop that particular power. If you want to develop precognition, you meditate on the capacity of causation, on the concept of causation. And by doing that, you enter causation, and at that point, you're able to look through the veil of the illusion of time. And each one of these cases, the fact of doing samadhi combined with attention on an object means that you merge with the object. So if you have a friend and you want to know the friend better than they know themselves, you do this siddhi where you merge with your friend, and that would be what we would currently call telepathy. But it would be really, really good telepathy, much better than these kind of snippets that we see in the laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to simply inform people who are doing meditation now that these are effects that have been known for many thousands of years. Some of them are amenable to being tested in the laboratory and do not require meditating forever to do them. And we can confirm now that from a scientific perspective that some of the elementary siddhis are real. What that tells us then is that Patanjali was not writing a fairy tale. He wasn't making up the stories about these special powers, he was telling it the way it is.
Hmm.
What's missing then is that some of the siddhis are basically like super comic book heroes.
I was just going to say, it sounds like a Marvel Universe school for superpowers and superheroes.
Exactly. And so then people can realistically say then, well, how come we don't see people flying around? why don't we see people being invisible and so on? Real comic book stuff.
That's the FAA. Sorry.
Some of that, yes. You need a license if you're going to start flying. But there's an interesting prohibition that's stated within the Yoga Sutras that says that when you are able to develop these siddhis, that you shall not demonstrate them. And the reason is very simple, that these are powers, and like any power, power is seductive. And if you begin to demonstrate your siddhis because you want to impress other people, it is seductive and you will become Darth Vader.
And basically, humans are ego-bound and they're weak and they fall prey to all that stuff, okay?
And you see this even today in India, where the gurus, who supposedly have special powers, are called godmen. That's the English term that's used in India. Many of them claim to have special abilities, and maybe some of them do, but a lot of them don't. And even if they had some ability to begin with, and as a result were able to attract a lot of followers, most of them seem to immediately fall into cults. And they're no longer interested in helping the individuals, but more interested in maintaining the cult and getting a lot of power and money.
Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, et cetera, et cetera,
right.
et cetera.
So the yogis knew this thousands of years ago.
Okay, let me stop you there, because I want to ask this question. For 3 minutes now, I've been thinking, how do I insert this? Mm-hmm. Do you think, Dean, we're the first? Are we the first civilization, high-tech civilization on the planet, or could this information be a pass-down from tens of thousands of years ago, degraded into an oral tradition, and then reassembled as a written set of keys and guides, because it's basically an ancient science of which we've lost total contact with?
I can't say that I would deny that, and especially given
that's so
that
scientific.
Well, I mean, I'm reluctant to say I believe something if I don't have any data.
Well, no, I understand. You have to be careful, but all right. I guess I'm saying, does the data impel you to consider seriously that we didn't just come up with this in the last few thousand years? This has a much longer legacy.
No, I think what I would say is that there are certain types of ancient wisdom, and I don't know how far back ancient goes. But given that we're beginning to find, as archaeology progresses, we're seeing that modern-type humans have been around much longer than we thought.
Well, look at what they found in Turkey, 12,000-plus years, and it's stunning. And as my friend John West used to say about Egypt, it wasn't a development, it was a legacy.
Right.
So I forget the name of the place, Tell, or whatever it is, there in Turkey. Mm-hmm. It's obviously the culmination of an awful lot of previous knowledge all assembled in one place.
Right. And because of that, I'm more willing to say at this point that some of that ancient knowledge may have been degraded over time, as the knowledge is, and they knew a lot more than we did.
Mm.
So it is. We can think of this as a kind of rediscovery. I think the new thing that may be in play now is that science might be new. Because if there was something like more advanced science than we have today, we would probably be able to find artifacts that look scientific in some way, or at least the kind of technologies that we're aware of. And maybe they leapfrogged the kind of technology we have today and will be...
And got that Skype problem again.
...be more along the lines of what I would call consciousness technologies. And
yes.
At that point, we won't need cell phones, and we won't need all this big hunks of metal all over the place, because we will learn how to do things with our mind, which
okay.
I think is more
okay.
fundamental than the physical world.
Okay, I want to ask two more questions here, and then I want to ask a big question. You say as you open your book, you started with this remarkably weird question: was Buddha just a nice guy? What did you mean by that?
This question comes about because, as you may know, that the Dalai Lama has been having dialogues with scientists and Buddhist monks for many years now, 25 or more years. And in almost every meeting, he will talk to the scientists and they will compare Buddhist lore against science. But the Dalai Lama at some point says, well, what about reincarnation? And what about our oracle that can foresee the future? What does science have to say about this? And because the scientists who are invited to talk to the Dalai Lama are orthodox, they say, oh, we don't know anything about that. And they quickly stop the discussion. In fact, in one of the more recent discussions, the Dalai Lama again brought up this notion of telepathy and reincarnation and was kind of admonished by one of the scientists that said, now, we told you we weren't going to talk about that. So at IONS, we're trying to change this by making it safe for scientists to talk about these things. The reason why they try to hush up the Dalai Lama is because it literally is not safe for one's career as a scientist to talk about these things openly.
And isn't that a sad commentary on so-called science, Dean?
Science, I think, should be open and tolerant, and it's going to be like any other human affair. There are taboos, and you don't break the taboos.
Now, there is evidence all over the planet now that things are changing at Warp 9 in all different fields. What about the reception to your work? Have you seen any glimmers? This is kind of an aside. Have you seen any glimmers on the horizon that your work and the Seven Sigma results is actually finding an audience that it gets it? Scientific audience?
So. Yes, I think that is happening.
Ah.
Maybe the last 5 years and beginning to accelerate. So.
Well, that's cool. Any specifics you want to tell us?
Well, like, for example, last year when I was invited to Australia to speak to the leaders of Australia,
right,
roughly 200 people who are in charge of their government, their business, their education, and their military, a private affair, where I was talking about cyber search. And the reason was that the leaders around the world are now recognizing that we're faced with a lot of apocalyptic scenarios. And they're looking for strategic thinkers.
Out-of-the-box solutions.
Yes. And they're willing now to entertain things which they were not able to before.
How interesting. Necessity being the mother of you-know-what.
Well, yes. The crisis will push for... I mean, also that leaders at every level know that they have to rely on their intuition because you never have enough information to make the right choice.
You remember what Obama's chief of staff said? Never let a good crisis go to waste.
Yeah.
So this is an opportunity to get these folks to think unthinkable things.
Yes.
I was thinking earlier when we were talking about 9/11 and the idea of terrorism and the shock value, you know, when four or five guys with a few AK-47s shooting 132 people in Paris can paralyze the world for a week, that's what they want. They want to cause shockwaves in the consciousness and fear. Are our guys, are the good guys, looking at the antidote for that in the consciousness realm, having nothing to do with drones and smart weapons and Abrams tanks and all that crap, which is not going to work?
It's a big problem. But what you mentioned this about the unthinkable. That was the actual title of the seminar in Australia, Thinking the Unthinkable.
How cool.
And this is not just Australia. This is happening in all countries around the world. So it is a kind of a door opening to be able to discuss this, still not publicly. They're mostly in private meetings, but they're at very, very high levels.
Yeah. By the way, the site in Turkey is Göbekli Tepe. Kicking myself for forgetting it. Thank you, M. And it is rewriting early history because the damn stuff is over 12,000 years old.
Right.
And it appears to have been deliberately buried. You know, when this first came to light, and I guess the archaeologist who's been doing this since the mid-90s has only excavated something like 5% of the site. When it came out that it had been deliberately buried, Dean, it sounded to me like someone knew there was some kind of a catastrophe that was going to wipe out all the stuff that you said we should be looking for, the, you know, high-tech trinkets.
Mm-hmm.
And leaving this buried left it preserved so we, you know, thousands of years later, could kind of retro-engineer what had happened and figure out who they were, what they were, what they were doing. In other words, is it an archive? Did that ancient culture, if it ever existed, or cultures, plural, did they leave us clues to figure this out all over again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be nice if we were to X-ray the big stones there, because we might find that there's something inside the stone.
Oh, how cool!
Yeah.
I have never heard that proposed.
No, you start tapping on one of the stones and crack it a little bit, and an android will come out.
Or a little panel will open, and there'll be a little flashing light, and it says, go to XX North, XX, you know, West. Or anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So, sure, the supernormal is talking about an ancient method. Where slowly science is catching up to confirm that some of the ancient lore is correct. We're also reasonably sure that some of the ancient lore was wrong. And so I think what we have the new opportunity here is to take the best of ancient knowledge, the best of modern knowledge, and create a new integration and actually make a big advancement.
Mm. And again, for folks that are calling, we're going to take calls after the bottom of the hour, so please be patient. I got a couple more myself here. Okay, on your book, let me think about this. We talked about this current scientific skepticism and the fact that you say now over the last 5 years you've seen some changes. Going back to the terrorism thing, has anybody from the Pentagon or you know Homeland Security or whatever actually contacted you and said, how can you help?
No.
Why not?
Well, there's still the giggle factor. And
yeah, but the CIA did remote viewing experiments back in the 70s.
Only because it was classified. Wasn't in the public domain.
So that no one could giggle.
Right.
Hmm.
So, and of course, now the way that the military would gain money to do this sort of thing is by having allocation through Congress. And Congress doesn't do anything anymore, so the money can't move.
Well, but you said for $20,000 you could wire the world and we could, you know, look at this data in ways with public input that is unbelievably important but not being done because there's no funding. So
right.
couldn't you crowdsource some experiments? Like could you put together a group of people that would actually anticipate the next event based on this apprehension that something bad is coming?
Yes, so we've thought about crowdsourcing. Again, it's a matter of timing. We, like all scientists, are constantly raising money to do their work. We're no different than that. Our job is a little bit more difficult because there aren't that many donors that are interested in this. And also, the large foundations are not interested in funding these kinds of things. There's no money for this from the NIH, and there's no from the NSF. Even large private foundations are not interested in this. And to a large extent, it's still because of the taboo. You know, with the taboo here is there are people who have religious objections to looking at these kinds of phenomena.
Hmm.
People have scientific objections because it looks like it's a little bit too close to religion. The history of this field, there's certainly among mediums and other psychics, and many of them have been con artists. And so because of all of that baggage, it's unusual to find foundations and even donors who are willing to fund it.
So you're saying, in essence, that the problem with studying consciousness is consciousness or the lack of.
No, you can get money to study consciousness as a brain activity.
No, but I'm talking the real thing.
Yeah.
Not the physiological bells and whistles. I'm talking about what we've just been discussing. Is it possible to get that funded by crowdsourcing it?
It probably is possible to get a small amount of money. I mean,
how do you define small?
Well, it's like the Bernie Sanders approach that we were
yes.
very happy because we're
he's
getting
$2. He's got 5 million people giving $27 a piece, and he's got $44 million in March alone.
Yeah. So it may be possible, and one of our colleagues has tried this in developing a smartphone app and was moderately successful at that. So we could do it, but for me at least, it's a matter of time. I'm so busy doing so many things that this is just one more thing on the list, and I'm not sure that I want to tackle it right now.
Delegate, delegate, delegate. We'll hold it there. Yeah. We're at the bottom of the hour. One last half hour to go, and we're opening the phone lines, and you can ask Dean whatever questions that are on your consciousness. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. are back on the other side of midnight. Only one half. This has gone incredibly fast, and it's been too fast. So I guess, Dean, we're going to have you back. Ryan is called in. Ryan, what is your question for Dr. Radin?
Two quick questions, and I'll free the line for the next caller. Can you tell us any of the world events that have affected the random number generators that you're mentioning in the past couple of years? And the second question is, can you explain more about these number generators? What are they exactly? Are they digital? Are they, I mean, what are they? Have you looked at one? What does it look like? I'm curious about that. I mean, what are the number generators made up of? And I'll just take
We probably went a little too fast over that. So if you can back up and do a little technology for us.
Sure. I can say a little bit about some of the events from the Global Consciousness Project. I'm going to look here on the website because that tells me I can look at all the results. So, for example, there was Internet Peace Day in September of last year. There was a bunch of people do these worldwide meditations for peace, and that had a very significant result. Another one, let's see here, that...
See, again, it's the mass consciousness thing that I'm kind of baffled by, because if in a lab adding more people doesn't seem to change the effect, why can you see effects if it's global and there's millions? That I guess I'm missing something.
Well, remember that the GCP, as we call it, the Global Consciousness Project, people don't know that they're part of an experiment. So back in 2014, also on September 21st, there was another worldwide meditation for peace, a very significant result. It's difficult to estimate the total number of people. There are probably 10 or 20 million people involved in this massive meditation. Mm-hmm. And in general, we find that meditation in particular produces better results than for people who are involved in something like a terrorist activity, where people's minds are focused on the event, but there's also a lot of emotion associated with it. So when talking about in the laboratory, you can't stick 10 million people in a box, so it's more difficult to run. We can do experiments, as our friend Lynn McTaggart has tried experiments, where lots of people will look at something over the Internet.
Yeah, she wrote a book called The Field.
Right. And then a follow-up book talking about what she called The Bond, which was kind of an entanglement. And doing experiments to try this over the web, which is very, very interesting and clever results. We can't do everything, so we're very happy that there are colleagues out there doing other kinds of experiments.
Gosh, this needs crowdfunding. If anything did, this does, because it involves people, and people should be interested in people themselves.
Yeah, you'd think so. One of the miracles, actually, in all of this is that there's always been a small number of scientists for the last 150 years, but that are interested in this, but it takes a fair amount of pushing against the tide. And so there are very few academics who will admit being interested in this because they won't get tenure. Hmm. I mean, the taboo is very, very strong. And because of that, you don't have very many people who are trained in how to do these kinds of experiments and willing to take the risk. And that goes along with the lack of money, too.
Well, if there was more money, would there be more interest at the academic level because, you know, it's publish or perish, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. Hmm. If there was suddenly magic grants coming from the NSF or DARPA or someplace like that, I can guarantee you there will be a lot of scientists who would be very happy to do those experiments.
And what does that say about real science and human nature? Anyway, well, Darren yeah. Is calling in. Darren, you're on the air.
Hi, Dean. How's it going?
Very good.
It's nice to talk to you. Has there ever been a big event like a tsunami or something where it didn't have an effect on the random number generators?
Sure. Yeah. In fact, I'm sure we've had one of these events that have a tsunami in it. Let's see. Yeah. The tsunami in the Indian Ocean in 2004, which killed something like 250,000 people.
Yeah.
That showed an effect in the predicted direction, but it wasn't a significant effect. By comparison, the previous month, Yasser Arafat died, and that did show a significant effect.
And so, how do you interpret that?
We don't actually know. The effects that we see in each one of these events is fairly small. They're small effects. The reason why we end up with 7 sigma, which is a massive statistical outcome, is because the effects are small but relatively systematic.
Systematic, meaning?
Meaning that eventually they accumulate, they add up
to a
massive effect.
So you're basically increasing the signal-to-noise ratio with every new event.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. Can we use this to our benefit in a way in the future? I mean,
If we imagine some parallel world where we actually had 1,000 people working on this, could we use it as some sort of an advanced warning system or as a way of telling the difference between what people are thinking versus not thinking? Absolutely, we could. And there's kind of an effort in this direction in places like Google where they're looking at big data. You know, look at all of the Twitter feeds around the world and try to figure out what's the mood of people, what's the sentiment of people around the world, and that's valuable information.
Well,
this will provide another look.
Since Google is into all kinds of really interesting things, I forget who the head of Google is, but he's a really interesting guy. Have you just decided to, I can't remember his name. Have you decided to call him up someday and say, why don't you kind of set up this global experiment? We'll help you. You've got the resources. The data could be shared. In other words, it seems to me it's about negotiating, that terrible word, a deal, the right kind of deal.
Right. So it sounds like it should be pretty easy. Just call up the head of Google and call up the head of DARPA and make things happen. And, of course, that doesn't work that way. Larry Page.
Larry Page,
You need to find somebody who is an entree at those high levels.
So we're back to connectedness.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, networking is the way things work, and we're doing okay. I mean, we're able to do research and have colleagues working on it as well. But there's probably only about 20 of us in the world who are doing this.
Darren, you can't watch it all the time. Have you ever done a prediction yet, or is it all just after the fact?
This is all after the fact.
You have to know enough to know how to predict, and we don't know enough yet, right?
Yeah, we have some guesses based on what's happening in the data, but this would be a full-time job for a very good analyst.
Hmm. Darren, I'm going to move on because we have a lot of people orbiting.
Thank you.
Thank you
so much.
Okay, next caller, you're on the air.
Hello, is that me?
Yeah, it's you.
Oh, this is Robin from Minnesota. My question is the doctor, is he aware of the scalar phenomena at all? And could, it would seem that if there's any truth to that, and they've made experiments where they've found a scalar wave, could psi be a scalar phenomenon or consciousness itself?
It's an interesting question, and I have looked at scalar waves. We actually have some scalar antennas in the laboratory that we're using as part of an experiment on energy healing. And for reasons that I don't understand, I'm not even sure I like this, but we have recorded signals while an energy healer was doing healing, which appear to have been picked up by the scalar antennas. And these are, we're using caduceus coils as a particular kind of antenna. It's very bizarre because when you look objectively at the signal, it looks completely flat. There's like nothing there. And yet if you ask people who are sensitive to these kinds of things, psychics and other kinds of intuitives and so on, and we play that signal back, that was recorded by the scalar antenna, they say they can feel something. So it's
now
very bizarre.
How do you actually record the signal? I mean, do you transfer it? Does it become audio? Do you, how does the signal, signal appear?
We put the signal into A to D, audio to or analog to digital converter, 24 bits of resolution at 44 kilohertz.
This is an electromagnetic signal picked up by this caduceus antenna.
Yes.
So we're still at EM. We're not looking at anything else. It's just ordinary electromagnetics.
Well, it's remember, as a caduceus coil gets rid of the transverse wave. So if it is E&M, it's not conventional E&M.
Okay.
It's a different portion of E&M, which is in the equations, but generally people don't pay any attention to it.
To Whitaker?
Well, supposedly the scalar wave only affects the nucleus of the atom, so that's where all the quantum, you know, in the Zener diode, you know, the scalar wave could affect right down to the quantum level or whatever, and if the brain can generate that, the scalar wave.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a fringe area of electromagnetics. When I was in electrical engineering, nobody ever talked about this. I had to learn about it much later.
Hopefully it'll stay fringe, and they won't, all those weapons or somebody's, nightmare, pipe dream or whatever. But,
did you ever read that early 1900s paper by Whitaker that kind of gets into this area of scalar and?
I've read most of the literature. I don't recall I read that specific one, but I've read a lot of information about scalar waves. I don't think I believe most of it, just from an electrical engineering perspective.
Okay.
Hey, Robin,
I'm going to have to...
You think it would blow up your transmitter if you actually tried to transmit the waves out of phase like that,
We're not doing this. I mean, Tesla was into this as well, and we're not making giant Tesla coils or anything. We're passively recording what happens to be out there. And to my surprise, we seem to have gotten something. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to have to move on because lots of folks are stacked up. Thanks, Robin. Okay. Let's add. Oh, come on. The Wolfman. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you, Richard?
You're dropping out a bit.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm there. Hello.
You're on.
Yeah, I was wondering about, I called in before about a random number generator coming up with the number 47 more often than any other number. There's a website on this. I was wondering if the guest knew anything about that or if his results from his have showed 47 coming up more often than any other number.
No, I hadn't heard that either.
No.
Yeah, I mean, it's a prime number, so that's exciting. But
it may have other implications for me, for what we've been doing, but no, I haven't heard that. Can you email me at othersideofmidnight.com the web link so I can look at it?
Yeah, okay. I believe it's just called 47, the website, and it's between 1 and 100. So if the number is between 1 and 100, 47 seems to come up more often for some reason.
Well, that's easily testable.
Wouldn't that maybe be Gaussian or something?
Well, 47, I don't know. If you have a uniform distribution of 1 to 100, then 47 should not show up more often than anything else.
No, it shouldn't. Okay. Thank you, Wolfie.
You're welcome, sir.
Okay, let's bring in – oh, here's a good one. Torch, you're on the air. What do you want to ask Dean and put him on the spot? Come on.
All right. Good to have you back, Rich.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
Dean, how you doing? I got a question for you. Have you ever had a signature event which points to a consciousness, to an entity that may be responding to your queries?
A non-human entity?
Well, it could be non-human, any kind of entity, demonic, alien, whatever, but it would be a recurring specific signature, a contact,
For me, no. However, we work with mediums in some experiments, and mediums are always seeing entities everywhere, all the time. So I don't have any personal way of verifying what they claim, because we don't have any way of detecting invisible creatures. But on the other hand, when we do tests with mediums and they're doing the kinds of experiments that we do where they're talking, in their case, they claim they're talking to deceased people, they can get real information, verifiable information. So I'm not quick to discount the fact that they're talking about an entity on the other side of the room because they're able to do the tests that we ask them to do. So maybe they are seeing something, but I can't see it.
Yeah, I see this as opening the door to a dark realm of demonic contact.
Torch, that's just you. Come on.
That's just me. You know me.
Yes, we do.
All right. You guys have a good night.
Good question. Well, thank you.
I could add here that one of the things we ask from mediums is and we learn from mediums in a sense, is that just because you're dead doesn't mean you're smart and doesn't mean you're very nice.
That's a very good summation of some of that field. Okay, you're sitting in front of your computer, right?
Yes.
If you go to othersideofmidnight.com and go to the upper right-hand corner, click on Radio with Pictures, that takes you to your page tonight. Link number 2 at the very top is the graph of the terrorist attacks in Paris. Do you want to kind of tell us what we're seeing?
So that picture is all of the eggs that were running. There were 40 running at that time. And the blue line at the top of the graph is the predicted deviation. And as you see, the graph actually went down. It went down probably to a near significant degree, but
when you say down, what is up and down? What's the axis mean?
Up and down. These are measures having to do with the degree of variance among the various eggs. So if the variance is increasing, then the line will go up, and if it's decreasing, it'll go down. At this point, we don't have a very good meaning associated with the direction of the deviation.
Tell us physically what the deviation. In other words, it's becoming more random as opposed to less random.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it. Oh, that now. Come on, that's interesting data.
Yeah, that's yeah, sure.
It's something extraordinary going on here because there should be no deviation at all, right? Random is random is random. It should kind of be a random walk on that flat line in the middle, right?
Yeah.
So the fact that it gets more random, how can you get more random from random?
Because you think of this as a normal curve. And so if the normal curve becomes the two kinds of measurements that we take, one is that the normal curve becomes squished, kind of flat,
okay,
and peaked in the center. And the other one, it gets squished flat, and there's more out on the edges. So when there's more energy or more numbers out on the edges, like a squashed flat curve, that's usually what we see. But if the whole curve is squashed thin and all squished together, then we see this line going down. So there's room to move in both directions.
Okay, one of the assumptions in your model, in fact, in all physics, and we're all taught this back when we are in school, we have things called constants, right?
Right.
Suppose constants are not really constant. Suppose the background physics actually over time, either because of cycles or because of, you know, astronomical effects or because of things we don't understand, that the Eastern tradition of looking at things as cyclic, rising and falling, like the yuga cycles, suppose the physics is changing, so the conditions of 9/11 that you measured in 2001 are not the same physics that Paris occurred in 2015.
It's possible, yeah. Yeah, I mean, people like Rupert Sheldrake think that physical constants are more like habits.
Yes, yes. He's got a huge list of things that are not constant.
Mm-hmm. So apropos, we have an experiment that we're going to test to see whether the speed of light is a constant.
Oh, how cool.
And it's a very simple idea. You take a gigahertz clock or even a faster clock, a whole bunch of them, like a dozen of them, and you start them all at exactly the same time. And then you take half of them and you put them in the middle of a circle of meditators who are advanced meditators who are able to get into a state that they would call timelessness, where they're trying to basically erase time or slow it down. And then they do that for a while, and then you bring all of the clocks together and you see if they're still the same. Because the experience of these advanced meditators is that for them, time seems to slow down. And so if the clocks in their vicinity actually slow down, we would see that immediately because these gigahertz clocks are running, of course, at nanosecond speeds. And we would see whether or not there's actually a little shift in measurement of time itself.
So this would be in proximity. The clocks would all be with the meditators.
Yes. In this case, we do a proximity test.
Okay.
So that would be an easy way of seeing whether there's something about consciousness, especially in these unusual states of consciousness, that might push around these constants a little bit. I think it would be bad if the constants changed a lot.
Right.
You don't want that to happen.
No.
But if we can see even tiny little changes in a systematic way, well, that would be interesting.
Okay. By the way, when everybody calls, please mute your mics before I pick you up, because otherwise we have background extraneous noises. We have another caller. Tell us who you are and where you're calling from.
Hi. My name is Bren. I'm calling from Washington State.
Brendan?
Yep.
Ah, Washington. Nice night tonight in Washington. What's on your mind?
Yeah. It's a bit nippy, but yep.
What's on your mind?
So the reason why I'm calling is because I was wondering about... So he was doing studies about some kind of a mechanism at play to do with quantum entanglement, and how... my question is, how does that tie in with the phenomena produced or seen in the double slot experiment? I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but
you're incredibly intuitive. That's exactly one of the questions that I wanted him to ask. I'll answer.
Ah. Mm-hmm. Cool. And I'll take the answer off the air.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Brendan.
Yes, that's the good question. So I have less than 8 minutes to describe something which is incredibly complicated.
Oh, my God.
But so I'll do the best I can. So, yes, the double-slit experiment is like physics 101 in quantum mechanics, and it's the way to demonstrate the sensitivity of quantum objects to observation. And the way you do it is you set up a double-slit, you shine photons through it, and then you measure with a camera or some kind of a screen to see what you get after you send the light through the two slits. If you don't know which slit each photon goes through, then you will end up with an interference pattern. It makes light look as though it's behaving like a wave. If you do know which slit the photon goes through, then you will get a pattern that looks like the photons are particles.
Hmm.
Question here then is, are the photons shy? They don't like to be looked at? Like the feeling of being stared at by a photon? This is an outstanding problem in physics. It's not solved. It's called the quantum measurement problem. And actually, it's a opening for where consciousness might enter the quantum world. And so this is usually discussed by philosophers and physicists interested in quantum ontology. And we decided to do an experiment to see what would happen if you used consciousness to observe what was going on with the photons, to see if the mind's eye alone, not the physical eye, but the mind's eye, could you imagine that you were seeing the photons, what would happen to the interference pattern?
Oh.
So we've done now 18 experiments. We've run 1,000 sessions in the laboratory. We've run over 5,000 sessions online. And it's very clear from the data that when you ask people to mentally observe photons in a double-slit apparatus, that the interference pattern slightly collapses and becomes less wave-like and more particle-like.
Oh, my God, that sounds like Copenhagen.
This is actually very close to what John von Neumann had come up with as the solution to the quantum measurement problem. Because when you think about how would you know where the photon goes? Well, if you were thinking in mechanistic terms, you'd take a photodiode and you'd stick it behind one of the slits,
sure,
and then you would know. But from a quantum perspective, the photodiode is just another quantum object. So when you calculate what does this look like from a quantum perspective, it's just a more complicated wave-like structure. And now if you have something recording the photodiode, that's also a physical object. That's also described by quantum mechanics. You have even a more complicated quantum object, which is all wave-like. And this is true when you go to the eye, you go to the brain, all of it's physical. So von Neumann said that the only thing that seems to stop this chain of measurement would have to be extra-physical. That's the term that he used. And by that, he meant consciousness itself.
Oh, my gosh.
So we've been doing experiments which have been testing his notion, and we're finding that he's probably right. That consciousness is involved in quantum measurement. And if you push that idea a little bit, it probably means that consciousness is not physical in the way that we think of, at least as described by quantum mechanics.
Or it's extra-physical.
It's extra-physical. It's beyond the physical world as described by the quantum
world. Meaning it may be higher dimensional.
Yes.
Interesting.
Or something.
Or something. Yep. Well, mm-hmm. Yeah, we're arm-waving this morning, so we can say, or something.
Yeah, it's late enough to arm-wave.
We only got about a minute left. I want you to plug some stuff, your website, how people can get the book, and the fact that there's a whole bunch of interesting videos up on Radio with Pictures we didn't have time to get to. Mm-hmm. But the beauty of the website is you go back to the website, and long after the show has stopped airing, you can go back and listen to Dean discuss a lot of this, but on television. So, plugs. Mm-hmm.
So, Supernormal, buy the book, Amazon, many other places. And to learn more about the institute where I work, it's either ions.org or noetic.org. They both go to the same place.
Well, Dean, it's been so much fun to have you. This is our first sojourn together, but I'm hoping it will not be our last. I want to thank my guest this morning, Dean Radin, who is chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, founded by astronaut, former astronaut, late friend, Edgar Mitchell. You've been on the other side of midnight. Until the other side tomorrow, same time, same channel. Remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.